Hello and welcome to Doc Talk. Sarcoidosis is a systemic inflammatory disease of unknown origin that is categorized by the formulation of granulomas in various parts of the body, including the lungs, skin, heart, eyes, and brain. Though it does not always require medication, careful monitoring and management is always recommended, as it may present in fatigue, pain, small fiber neuropathy, and other comorbidities. Sarcoidosis is reported to affect roughly 30,000 patients yearly, with the majority of those cases originating from the African American community. The disease is three times more common in African American patients compared to white patients, and it presents more frequently in African American women. Ogigua Obi is the director of the Sarcoidosis Center of Excellence at ECU, as well as an assistant professor there, and a member of the Scientific Advisory Board of the Foundation of Sarcoidosis Research. In this interview with Associate Editor Juliana Grassi, Dr. Obi speaks of the disparities associated with the disease, the challenges patients face, and how sarcoidosis, which is called the great mimicker by some clinicians, can be differentiated from other diseases.
What is sarcoidosis and how does it affect a patient's quality of life?
Sarcoidosis is a chronic inflammatory disease that is characterized by the formation of tiny clumps of inflammatory cells known as granulomas, and they can accumulate or deposit in any organ or any part of the body. The way I describe it to my patients is I let them know that, you know, for reasons that we don't fully understand, the body's immune system goes into a hyperdrive or an overdrive and forms these clusters of immune cells or inflammatory cells that deposit anywhere in the body. Now, we don't know what causes sarcoidosis. We think it has to do with a gene and environment interaction. So certain environmental triggers cause sarcoidosis in patients who are genetically susceptible. Now, it's a rare disease, meaning less than 200,000 people, as we know, here in the US have the disease. Now, in terms of how it affects a patient's quality of life, I think it does that in so many different ways. Now, a lot of patients who have sarcoidosis may have absolutely no symptoms at all. But there's also a significant proportion of patients who will present with symptoms. Now, sarcoidosis can present in lots of different ways because it can affect multiple organs in the body. The most common symptoms would be shortness of breath and cough. And that's because, you know, over 90% of patients who have sarcoidosis have it in their lungs. But because it affects the heart, the skin, the eyes, pretty much, you know, any organ system in the body, they can also present with lots of diffuse symptoms. One of the most debilitating and one of the more common symptom presentations is fatigue or tiredness. Now, all of these symptoms together contribute to a decreased quality of life in patients. Plus also, you know, the anxiety of having a rare disease that people don't know much about. It causes angst to patients. Plus, it also limits their choices in terms of who they can go to get care. So all of that contribute to the low quality of life in patients who have sarcoidosis.
Thank you. And when you're saying that it can appear in different places in the body, and some patients have, you know, more symptoms than others and are more affected by it than others, is that related to the location in the body that it's presenting?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. So having it in certain organs is more severe than in other organs. So certainly having it in the heart, the brain, the eyes, those are more severe disease presentations. But even beyond the organ involvement, we've also found that there are certain groups of people, specifically African Americans and more in African American women, who tend to have overall more burden of disease. So they tend to have more severe disease. They tend to have more organ involvement. They tend to have more advanced and more chronic disease.
So would you say that it presents in the African-American population more so than other populations?
It does. Sarcoidosis affects African-Americans 3 times as more commonly than it does Caucasians. And it affects African-American women about 1.5 times more commonly than it affects African-American men. So by and large, African-American women have or bear a significant burden of this disease.
Absolutely. And can you speak to the disparities that are seen within this population of the disease?
Absolutely.
I'm sure there's some there just based on the numbers that you just gave me.
Yes, yes. There's a lot of disparities, a lot of barriers, a lot of challenges that patients with sarcoidosis face. Specifically, those challenges and barriers are more pronounced, significantly more so in African-American women population. And the way I refer to it is the triple whammy of barriers or challenges. And this has to do with multiple barriers, including racial, gender, and socioeconomic barriers to care. So the socioeconomic barriers stem from the fact that African Americans, especially African American women, are more likely to be in the lower socioeconomic or lower financial status in society. And this makes it very difficult for them to, first of all, make appointments, secondly, to seek specialty care, and in a lot of cases, to follow treatment regimens, which may be, you know, complex or require multiple medication doses. Now, it also affects where they live. And we know that here in the US, over 50% of your disease outcome is really dependent on your zip code. Mm-hmm. Now, the racial and the gender barriers are also significant. There's a lot of biases, both implicit as well as explicit, that both physicians as well as patients have. And it overall impacts care. So from the providers, those barriers may result in not paying attention or dismissing symptoms that patients may present with, or it may affect the physician-patient relationship, and that results in mistrust in the system for mm-hmm. the patients. Now, on the patient side, if you don't trust your physician, if you don't feel like your physician is listening to you or hearing you, you're less likely to make appointments. You're also less likely to be adherent to the medications or to whatever the treatment plan is. And now, gender barriers. We know that, you know, lots of times, whether it's, you know, African or Caucasian women, they tend to think or feel, or there's a lot of study that shows that, you know, they're treated differently. And this barrier is magnified multiple times over for African-American women. So certainly this population faces a lot of barriers to their care.
I know there's been some research on discrimination and things like that in terms of, you know, the healthcare setting. But I think a lot of people tend to think like, you know, in more apparent ways like racism and sexism. And sometimes, you know, I think these are implicit biases that people are unaware of, you know, healthcare professionals or otherwise might not even be aware that they're doing this on occasion. And so they might not realize that they have, you know, to address this to better care for their patients. So I was just wondering if you could speak to that.
Yeah, there are certainly a lot of biases that that we have. And so maybe what I should, I'll just share really an experience with one of my patients. I'll call her Miss K. Miss K was referred to me in the clinic. She had been diagnosed with sarcoidosis about, you know, 20 or 25 years before I met her. And she was referred to me because her disease had progressed and she was, you know, declining care. The whole time she had sarcoid, she had been on prednisone and she had gained a lot of weight. Now, prednisone is a first line treatment for patients who have sarcoidosis. She had, you know, gained a lot of weight. Her BMI was now over 14. She had developed multiple complications of the disease, including high blood pressure, diabetes, and sleep apnea. At the time I saw her, her disease had progressed. She now had fibrotic lung disease and pulmonary hypertension, both of which are, you know, severe manifestations of the disease. And really looking through her chat, you could see where, you know, there were multiple comments about, oh, she doesn't care about herself. She's non-compliant. She, you know, doesn't make appointments. And of course, all these were put in the chart, but they reflect biases. Now, talking to the patient and getting to know the patient, I found out a lot. She was, you know, single. She was caring for her aged parents. She was a high school dropout. She worked in a factory. She really didn't have any paid time off. And so you could see how all of that would make keeping appointments or making appointments very difficult for her. And she actually let me know that, you know, first of all, if she doesn't work, she doesn't get paid. And for her to be able to come see us in clinic, she has to take, you know, a certain time off. And if she is late getting back to work, she doesn't get paid. You know, it reflects poorly against her. And so again, those are barriers, barriers that are socioeconomic in origin. But I think the way those that was interpreted by, you know, physicians is she doesn't care. That's a bias. That's an implicit bias. Those are things that we need to become more cognizant of. Now, she also had her biases. She, you know, we talked about why she, you know, didn't want to use oxygen, which is what was prescribed, and she had declined. And she let me know, first of all, that it would make her look sick. We also asked why, you know, she really was missing some appointments, some certainly she couldn't make, but she really didn't, you know, engage with her physician. He had prescribed methotrexate at some point and she declined to use it. There wasn't a communication as to why she should use it, but she also took it a few times. It didn't help. And so she filed some information in her mind as he doesn't like me, he's going to give me the medications that don't work. So all those are both, you know, implicit biases, as well as I would say to some extent, explicit biases that, again, systemic, that we have grown up with, that we have to become more self-aware of so that we can address them and at least understand where they are coming from when we deal with patients, especially patients who are socioeconomically disadvantaged.
Absolutely. I know I've read research based on implicit bias, but even just based on the language that's used in, you know, medical notes. And, you know, like you said, though, it does go both ways. And once, you know, it seems like once that relationship is kind of formed or, you know, the distrust is there, they just kind of keep feeding off each other. So,
yeah,
you know, I always, you know, ask professionals like yourself, like, awareness and advocacy in this, you know, space for rare diseases is really important. And so I guess, can you speak a little bit to that and how, you know, the need for awareness really impacts, you know, the field from your point of view?
Yeah. So I think one of the points you made is very well taken. Being aware means being aware of the challenges that your patients face. It means being aware of the fact that if they don't make an appointment, you need to go one step further to find out why. It means, you know, being your patient's advocate, trying to find out what exactly those barriers or those challenges are that, A, keep them from getting their medications or, you know, keep them from being compliant with the regimens that you have prescribed. If somebody has to choose between putting food on the table for her family and taking a medicine that she doesn't see or immediately experience the benefit from, she's more likely going to choose putting food on the table. It also means being aware of overall the general ambience in which you practice. And when I say that, what do I mean? Just, you know, think about, you know, certain clinic locations might put some of your patients in at a disadvantage. I think, again, just going back to Ms. K, my patient, some of the things she shared with me was her physician didn't look like her, didn't always understand the way she spoke. Mm-hmm. None of the clinic people, you know, at certain points looked like her. And so if you're, for instance, an African-American woman like myself, and you walk into a clinic where everybody looks different, and not only do they look different, there's a perception that you're treated differently, that's likely to impact your care. And so there's research from, I think, Dr. Logan Harper from Cleveland Clinic, as a focus group research that looked at barriers to care in, you know, groups of patients. And so she had about 30 patients and multiple groups, and they would come together and talk about, you know, what the perceived barriers to care were. It was a good mixture, African-Americans, Caucasians, patients from lower zip codes, as well as from, I shouldn't say lower, patients from lower socioeconomic zip codes, as well as those who came from more affluent zip codes. And, you know, the takeaway from that was that they all reported certain common barriers that they faced. They were all very worried when they got the diagnosis of sarcoidosis. They were all very frustrated that they had physicians that didn't quite understand what the disease entailed. But by and large, those who were from the lower socioeconomic status, which was predominantly African-American women, were more likely to report mistrust in the system. And they were more likely to report a perception that they were treated differently, either because they earned less, they had less education, or they looked different. And so being aware of all those biases would go a long way towards us as providers taking better care of our patients.
Definitely. I know with rare diseases, it can be hard to even get to the point of a diagnosis. So to then have to navigate, you know, these additional obstacles just because of, you know, where you are in life or who you are in life, you know, that must just add to the complications. So can you speak a little bit about how you diagnose or, you know, differentiate sarcoidosis from maybe some more common conditions that it might be mistaken for?
Yes. So sarcoidosis is one of those diseases that is sometimes described as the great mimicker. First of all, it can affect, you know, multiple organs, both, you know, at the same time, the lungs being the most commonly affected organs. And so it can present in lots of different ways. Now, we talk about the three tenets of making a diagnosis of sarcoidosis. The first being an appropriate clinical scenario, meaning the patient presents with, you know, signs and symptoms that are suggestive or consistent with sarcoidosis. Bearing in mind that this can range from, you know, cough, shortness of breath, to just non-specific symptoms like fatigue, weight loss, to, you know, ocular involvement, cutaneous involvement, cardiac involvement, all of those. And so having the constellation of symptoms and appropriate radiographic findings, classically in the lungs, you would have, you know, mediastinal and hilar lymphadenopathy, findings in the heart, in the brain, all of that. So that's the second. And then when you have that, you know, clinical radiographic picture, getting tissue diagnosis is important. And so you would biopsy, you know, whatever organ was affected. Of course, mostly we're biopsying the lungs, the skin. Sometimes you would biopsy the conjunctiva. But those three tenets, in addition to excluding all other known causes of granulomatous diseases, is really how we make a diagnosis of sarcoidosis. Now, the latter part may involve multiple testing, as you exclude other known causes of sarcoidosis, and overall may, I would say, prolong the process of making a diagnosis. I think the one comforting thing is that the diagnosis becomes more secure with time. So the more you see the patient and take care of that patient, the more comfortable you are that you've made the appropriate diagnosis.
We'd like to thank Dr. Obi for being a part of the program, and thank you for listening. If you like this and want more rare disease coverage, make sure to follow us on Twitter, LinkedIn, and Facebook. We'll be back next week with a new episode of Doc Talk. Until then, stay safe and stay healthy.